First reading is from Genesis chapter 5, beginning at verse 1, and that's found on page 5 of the Church Bibles. Genesis 5, beginning at verse 1. This is the written account of Adam's line. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female and blessed them. And when they were created, he called them man. When Adam had lived 130 years, he had a son in his own likeness, in his own image, and he named him Seth. After Seth was born, Adam lived 800 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Adam lived 930 years, and then he died. When Seth had lived 105 years, he became the father of Enosh, and after he became the father of Enosh, Seth lived 807 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Seth lived 912 years, and then he died. When Enosh had lived 90 years, he became the father of Kenan. And after he became the father of Kenan, Enosh lived 815 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Enosh lived 905 years, and then he died. When Kenan had lived 70 years, he became the father of Mahalalel. And after he became the father of Mahalalel, Kenan lived 840 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Kenan lived 910 years, and then he died. When Mahalalel had lived 65 years, he became the father of Jared. And after he became the father of Jared, Mahalalel lived 830 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Mahalalel had lived 895 years, and then he died. When Jared had lived 162 years, he became the father of Enoch. And after he became the father of Enoch, Jared lived 800 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Jared lived 962 years, and then he died. When Enoch had lived 65 years, he became the father of Methuselah. And after he became the father of Methuselah, Enoch walked with God 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Enoch lived 365 years. Enoch walked with God. Then he was no more, because God took him away. When Methuselah had lived 187 years, he became the father of Lamech. And after he became the father of Lamech, Methuselah lived 782 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Methuselah lived 969 years, and then he died. When Lamech had lived 802 years, he had a son. He named him Noah and said, "He will comfort us in the labour and painful toil of our hands caused by the ground the Lord has cursed." After Noah was born, Lamech lived 595 years and had other sons and daughters. Altogether, Lamech lived 777 years and then he died. After Noah was 500 years old, he became the father of Shem, Ham and Japheth.
When men began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward. When the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them, they were heroes of old, men of renown. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on earth, and his heart was filled with pain. So the Lord said, "I will wipe mankind, whom I have created, from the face of the earth, men and animals and creatures that move along the ground, and birds of the air, for I am grieved that I have made them." But Noah found favour in the eyes of the Lord.
And I don't know about you, but I think when we hear this passage, there's all those sort of questions spring to mind. You know, what's with Enoch? Who are the Nephilim? The sons of God marrying the daughters of men? What's going on there? You know, why is that happening? Why is God grieved? He knew that they were going to be evil. So what, has it caught him by surprise? We have all those sorts of questions, and those questions are right and legitimate and fair. But the bigger question, of course, is what is God telling us by this passage? What is the message that he's got for us? I think it's one of those passages which we skip over. Kind of, we might look at Cain and then we'll get into the flood. But this is a passage that we tend to think, well, no, we'll just skip over it. Maybe it'll raise a few questions, but that's about it. But I want to say to you that I don't know that we should read it that way. It does have a message for us. If you look at chapter 5, the start of verse 5, it says, "This is the written account of Adam's line." So we are getting a definite section here. If you look at chapter 2, verse 4, you'll see the first time we got that little statement, it said, "This is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created." Okay, so that's a whole section from chapter 2, verse 4, through to chapter 5. And then if you come over to chapter 6 and verse 9, it says, "This is the account of Noah." Okay, so Genesis is broken up by all these accounts, or generations, if you like. And here, the passage we're looking at tonight, it seems to be an account on its own. It's a particular unit. And so it's got something to teach us. And so what does it have to tell us? What is it saying to us? Well, firstly, it begins by telling us again that man is blessed, that humans are particularly blessed by God. Look at the first two verses. "This is the written account of Adam. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female and blessed them. And when they were created, he called them man." That's a little bit of a summary, isn't it, of what we've already seen in Genesis chapter 1. God created humans like he created everything else. But he created humans as a special creature among all the other things in creation, because humans represent God to the rest of creation. They are in his image. And so humans are particularly special. And humans consist of male and female. They are both equal and both in the image of God. And being in the image of God, God has blessed them. And so that's the first thing that it emphasises, is humans are blessed by God. And particularly what's being emphasised here is that that blessing doesn't stop with Adam. It's not as if Adam and Eve received it and now they've been kicked out of the garden and it's all stopped. Look what's said in verse 3. "When Adam had lived 130 years, he had a son in his own likeness, in his own image, and he named him Seth." You see, it's being emphasised that this blessing of being in God's image is being passed on through the generations. We heard about Seth, Adam's son, last week. He was a replacement for Abel. But here we're told about him again, and we're told not a whole lot about him. We don't find out much about Seth. We don't kind of know what his hobbies were. And we don't know what school he went to or anything like that. You know, if you kind of looked up Seth on Facebook or something on the internet and you found, you know, Googled Seth, there wouldn't be a whole lot of information. It would just be, well, he's in Adam's likeness. He has the image, which of course means that he has God's image and God's likeness. That is, the image of God is being passed on across the generations. It hasn't been lost by sin. Just hold on a second, my watch has dropped to the ground, which is bad news for all of us. That's all, we've got ages, terrific. Okay, but that's not the only blessing that's being emphasised in these verses. The blessing of children is being emphasised in these verses as well. The blessing of children is being emphasised in the repetition. Someone pointed out the repetition in the question, and that was a good thing to notice. There is a real repetition going on in the pattern, isn't there? The pattern begins with Seth, and it happens for every single person who's mentioned after that. Look at it with Seth in verse 6. "When Seth had lived 105 years, he became the father of Enosh. And after he became the father of Enosh, Seth lived 807 years, and notice, and had other sons and daughters." It gets repeated every time, "and had other sons and daughters." And so every account has those characteristics. "Such and such lived so many years, became the father of a son, and after the son was born, they lived a long time, and they had other sons and daughters." That is emphasising blessing, isn't it? These people lived a long time. They had an heir, and then they also had lots of other kids. They are great blessings. That's what's being emphasised. Now think for a moment, a little bit of history. Henry VIII. Think about Henry VIII. He lived quite a long time, a reasonable length of time for his day and age. But he's famous, of course, isn't he, for having so many wives. He kept on bopping off his wives. Why did he do that? Because he wanted an heir. That's why he was doing it, not hair on his head. He was wanting a son to succeed him on the throne. That's why he kept knocking off all those wives. And then when he had a son, history buffs, who was the son that he had? James. I thought it was Edward the Sixth. I could be wrong on that. I thought it was Edward the Sixth that he had. And Edward the Sixth died at a very young age. I think it was either 16 or 23 when he died. He was very young. And so, see, here you have two kings of a great empire. Two kings, one who had a great struggle to have an heir, and the other who died young. And yet here, people have long life. They have an heir, and then they have many other children as well. It's emphasizing blessing, and particularly blessing in the line of Seth. Notice there's no mention of Cain's line. It's just the line of Seth that we're being told about here. And as I've said, I think that's also what's going on in chapter 6 with the sons of God marrying the daughters of men. I think that's what's being emphasized. It's just saying that marriages were taking place. And then in verse 4, marriages were taking place and they started having lots of children. Sons and daughters were being born by them. And so I think it's emphasizing that there is blessing. And so, you see, there is this continued blessing, and that is still being picked up on here in Genesis. So, yes, the curse has come. Yes, there is judgment. Yes, there is sin. But the blessing of creation is still there, and humans still carry God's image. They are marrying and having children, the blessings that we talked about earlier on in chapter 2 and chapter 1. A couple of weeks ago now, Sarah announced here on Sunday night that Lisa and Steve McNabb had a beautiful daughter, Stephanie. Now, she is beautiful. And Stephanie has Down syndrome. We were told that as well. And you see, Stephanie is a great blessing. She is in the image of God. There are all sorts of wonderful creatures in this creation, amazing creatures. You can go to any zoo and see all sorts of creatures, and they are breathtaking and staggering. But only humans are in the image of God. It is a great privilege to have children. It is a wonderful thing to actually be entrusted with the care of one who is in the image of God. We are all tainted by the curse. All of us will die. We all have our difficulties and we have our disabilities, and they'll get worse as we get older and so on. And sometimes it's more obvious than with others. But all people are in the image of God. And that is a staggering blessing, an incredible blessing, to be the image and the likeness of God himself. Nothing else in all creation has that, except humans. And we see here then, from the genealogy of Adam, that humans are greatly blessed by God. They haven't forfeited that blessing by their sin. And yet we also see that they are terribly evil. They are terribly evil. Chapter 6, verse 5 is one of the most emphatic verses about this in the whole Bible. Look at it with me. Chapter 6, verse 5. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. That is emphatic, isn't it? How could you make that statement more negative? You couldn't do it, could you? Every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. If I'm right the way I'm reading chapter 6, that when it talks about the sons of God marrying the daughters of men, if that's not actually an evil deed that's being recorded there, then this chapter is not actually recording any evil deeds, if I've got that bit right. It's not recording any evil deeds. And if that's the case, that's quite striking, isn't it? Because what this verse is saying is, it's the thoughts of the heart. And so in contrast to chapter 4, where we hear of Cain murdering, then lying to God and Lamech with his terrible revenge and all those sorts of things, his great brutality, here the evil that's being emphasized is evil in our hearts, the inclination of our hearts. And that's what's being emphasized here. Man's heart is the problem. Wickedness is not necessarily seen in actions. It's in the heart. That's where the problem lies. Now, you might say, hearing that verse, you might say, well, hold on, that's just far too strong. It's so negative. And that's the problem with Christianity and the Bible, some say. They have such a negative view about humans. There's lots of people who do good things, aren't there? They're not just Christians, but people of all religions and no religions. They do many good things. In fact, some would say there's a bit of good in all of us. In fact, some people would go even further and say, no, humans are basically good. They just get tainted by the world around them. But we need to understand what is being said here. Here's the diagnosis of God himself about us. Every inclination of our heart is only evil all the time. What it's meaning is that on our own, left to our own devices, we do not want to glorify God. We want to take his glory from him and have it for ourselves. I think that's what God means in 6 verse 3 when he says, my spirit will not contend with man forever. He's saying, I think, I don't want to have to put up with humans constantly trying to steal my glory, competing with me, trying to take my place. I don't want to keep fighting with them about that. Of course, we do that in loads of different ways, don't we? Whether by denying God, or by claiming a credit for humanity, humans' great achievements, whether by telling God how we're going to worship him, and then praising ourselves for how we do it. Whatever it is, we take the credit rather than giving the credit to God, whether it's in our fake religion or all sorts of other ways. We take credit away from God. And so on our own, our hearts are only ever evil, all the time, contending against God, wanting the glory for ourselves rather than for him. As you heard in the prayers from Andrew, over the last week, many of us have seen the movie Amazing Grace about William Wilberforce. Wilberforce, the key mover in the abolition of the slave trade. Wilberforce is almost universally admired for his work in treating slaves with compassion as human beings and for passing a bill that abolished the slave trade and sowed the seeds for getting rid of slavery altogether. And see, he believed that slaves were in the image of God. Unlike a lot of the humanists of his time, he actually believed that slaves were in the image of God, and so while their skin was a different colour, they were human and needed to be treated with love and compassion. What's interesting about Wilberforce, though, is he wrote a book 10 years before the slave trade was abolished. And he said, you know, there's a lot of people, he's talking about England in the beginning of the 19th century, he said there's a lot of people that admire kind of Christian virtues, things like love, and things that Christians do. A lot of people admire those sorts of things. He said, you know, what people need to understand is the great doctrines of the Christian gospel. They're what's been forgotten. And what we really need to do is we need to deal with the human heart. That's where the problem is, in the human heart. See, Wilberforce knew that actually the thoughts and inclinations of the human heart are only evil all the time. And if you want to know what actually brought about the change for the abolition of slavery, it wasn't just some clever politician like Wilberforce. It was the fact that the gospel of Jesus Christ had been preached throughout England in the century beforehand. And so many people had come to believe that gospel, and so it had changed people's hearts. You see, the problem is in our hearts. Laws don't change anything. We know that, don't we? We see that in our society today. How are we going to deal with all the violence in our society in New Zealand? It's clear that our society just doesn't know where to turn, do they? What on earth are we going to do? What do you do in a situation where the sort of violence that's taking place in our country is taking place? What do you do? There is something that can actually break the cycle. It's the gospel of Jesus Christ. You see, humans on their own, every inclination of their heart is only evil all the time. What we needed is not a change of law or a change of economic conditions or to connect people with their roots or anything like that. We need a change of heart. And so we humans are only inclined to evil all the time. And so chapter 6, verse 6, it's one of the most tragic verses in the whole Bible. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. Isn't that awful? If you've ever sat down and read Genesis, just kind of started reading it through, before too long you hit that verse, and it is so tragic when you come across it. God had said everything is good, very good. Humans are the pinnacle of it. Now he's grieved in his heart that he'd made man on the earth. His heart is filled with pain. And so here is the disappointed God. I know it raises questions for us about God's sovereignty and his control over evil and so on, but we need to push them to one side, really, and feel the weight of what is being said here. The evil of the human heart causes God great grief and pain and disappointment. I don't know if you've ever spoken to parents, good, upright parents, and they've had a child who has really gone off the rails, maybe done criminal things, things that they are utterly ashamed of. I don't know if you've ever spoken to parents in that situation, and their children have deeply hurt other people. There is that terrible pain in their voice and in their heart as they speak about their children. And that's sort of what is being said about God here. That's what's in his heart as he looks at those who he created to bear his image, only being bent on evil all the time. And how instead of ruling under him, how they can actually grab at his rule and replace him and take his place. And so we also see in this chapter how God deals with his disappointment with humans. There are two ways that he deals with it, judgment and mercy. That's always the way God deals with it, judgment and mercy. Now, there's another key part to the pattern, isn't there, that keeps getting repeated in chapter 5, and it's the repeated refrain, and he died, and he died, and he died, and he died. That is, humans are blessed, yes, they live a long life, yes, they have lots of kids, yes, but they die. They keep coming under God's judgment. And in chapter 6:3, it seems that God is saying that he'll restrict man's life to 120 years, making the judgment of death more severe. Like birth, death is one of those great areas of controversy in our society. When someone dies young, people tend to think it's a bad thing, which it certainly is. But when people die a bit older, there's this sort of general feeling like, that's okay. They've had a good innings, is usually the expression. Everyone becomes a cricketer at that point. They've had a good innings. And so it's all okay. Some funeral places even see death as a great and wonderful send-off. But the Bible doesn't see death that way. Death is bad. It doesn't matter if the person's 100 years old or 1 year old. Death is always awful. It's a terrible thing. It's a sign of judgment. Because humans shouldn't die. They are in the image of God. Humans shouldn't die. They weren't made to die. They were made to live forever. It's horrible when relationships are permanently ended by death. That's not how things are supposed to be. Great lie of our age that they've had a good innings and so it's all okay. But death is terrible. And we get a foretaste of the judgment that God will bring with the flood in 6:7, where God says, I will wipe mankind whom I've created from the face of the earth, men and animals and creatures that move along the ground and birds of the air, for I am grieved that I have made them. See, here is how God deals with this disappointment. He deals with it with justice and fairness. He comes in judgment. We know judgment's right, don't we? When you hear of people committing atrocious crimes and then getting away with it, getting let off after a few years, we cry out. We know injustice is wrong. God is a God of justice. He has made humans to rule creation. Humans have tried instead to rule over God. And so God says, okay, you don't want me as the source of life, then I'll take your life away. It is completely fair. And yet, that's not God's only response to the rebellion of those who bear his image. And it never is. Judgment is never God's only response. His other response is that of mercy and grace. And there are two examples of God's mercy in the passage. The first is with Enoch, this curious character. It'd be a good name for a kid, wouldn't it? Enoch. You'd want to watch where he's walking. Hold on, we haven't found Enoch. Oh no. Anyway. Enoch. He doesn't suffer death. It's very striking with him because there's that pattern, so we're expecting it, and then we're expecting, and he died, but and then he just wasn't found. He walked with God, and then he wasn't found. Here, then, is one who avoids the judgment of God. And we're told of another who will avoid the judgment of God towards the end of the account. And it seems actually part of the point of this whole genealogy is to lead up to this one who is Noah, whose very name means comfort, and of whom we're told will bring comfort in the labour and painful toil caused by the curse. And so Noah is another one through whom God's mercy comes. And so this very sorry account of Adam ends on a note of judgment, but it finishes on one of hope. And the hope comes in verse 8 of chapter 6. And Noah found favour in the eyes of the Lord. Hallelujah. God's going to wipe out mankind, but Noah found favour in the eyes of the Lord. And the key question is, well, how on earth did he do that? See, if every inclination of his heart was only evil all the time, then how did he find favour with God? It's worth knowing that, isn't it? If you know that your heart is evil, here's one who found favour with God. How does he do it? Well, the answer is given to us in Hebrews chapter 11. Come with me over to Hebrews 11 and verse 5. Hebrews 11 and verse 5. It's on page 1168 of your pew Bibles. We're told about Enoch as well. Hebrews 11 verse 5, page 1168. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. And without faith, it's impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists, and he rewards those who earnestly seek him. By faith, Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear built an ark to save his family. By his faith, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. See, how did these men escape judgment? How did they please God? How did they find favour in the eyes of God? They found it by faith, by taking God at his word. When other people mocked it, they took God at his word, and they became heirs of righteousness. Of course, the writer of Hebrews, he's encouraging us to actually put our trust in Jesus. That's what he goes on to say. He goes through a whole list of people who live by faith, and he concludes in chapter 12, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you'll not grow weary and lose heart." You see, it's very discouraging, isn't it? Living in a world where every inclination of every person's heart is only evil all the time. It's very easy to get discouraged, isn't it? Especially if you're someone who wants to please God. It is easy to grow weary. When so few people want to live for God and walk with him, and when you get mocked for following Jesus, for wanting to live God's way and live by his word, it can be easy to give up, can't it? And of course, our hearts are sinful as well. We're not above that. And so when our own sin weighs us down, we get so frustrated with the way that we get entangled in it. It's such a true word, isn't it, there in Hebrews? The sin that so easily entangles. And we despair at the suffering and the death that we see in the world. It'd be easy to be crushed by disappointment, wouldn't it? It'd be easy to be crushed. And yet the way to cope is by faith. By putting our trust in the God who saves those who put their trust in him. By putting our trust in his Son, the Lord Jesus, who suffered the shame of the cross and is now at the right hand of God. What do you think your heart is like? Think you're basically good? Obey the Ten Commandments and I'll be accepted by God because I'm basically a good person? Or do you recognise that you desperately need God's mercy? And do you find it difficult and discouraging in this world, where you see so much evil in yourself and in others? Well, if you do find it like that, then don't lose heart. Keep your trust in the Lord Jesus Christ, and he will bring you home. Because the God who rescued Enoch and rescued Noah is the same God who was saved by sending his son Jesus. Let's pray we put our trust in him.